The year is 1976, and auteur extraordinaire Robert Altman once again brings his free-form and experimental eye for filmmaking to audiences whether they wanted it or not. Always divisive, Altman showcased a latter-day career Paul Newman as Buffalo Bill. But rather than show him as a frontier legend we all know and love, he shows us an entertainer, a huckster, and a man crumbled under his fragile ego. Not one to stray too far away from his calling cards of ensemble casts, wandering camera work, and offbeat characters, Altman delivers a film destined to be appreciated by only his biggest fans. This week on Back to the Balcony, we cover 1976's Buffalo Bill and the Indians. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. Also known as Sitting Bull's History Lesson, this was a much-needed revisit from my days of trying to subject myself to every Robert Altman film ever made, or at least the ones that were available in his catalog, because some were out of print, not streaming, not easy to find. So the ones that were available to me, I just dove into. Some of them I watched repeatedly. Others, I didn't absorb the first time. And this was one of them. I'm glad that we revisited it because I wanted to see if I felt differently after, let's say, 15, 20 years since I saw it for the first time and have a better appreciation for, like I said, the free form and wandering style of a Robert Altman movie. What I like about Altman, dude, is his movies are an endurance test, right? It's an endurance test to see if you are the audience for what he gives you. Are you married to the idea of a narrative film with a story, with a beginning, middle, or an end? Or can you open yourself up to something that's a little bit more character-driven and, let's say, situation-driven rather than A, B, and C three-act plot structure? And I think you and I both know what kind of film appreciator I am. I love it when a film goes off the beaten path. I don't need a narrative storyline. I don't need a beginning, middle, and end. If a filmmaker does a good job at making characters interesting and seducing me with just offbeat quirkiness, then you've got a fan. You've got me as one of your followers. And after this revisit, I'm going to tell you, I loved this fucking movie so much because it's exactly what I just described. It's nowhere near a narrative form. It is not only an observation of these characters in this like what if situation, right? And I'll get into the Alan Rudolph part of it in a minute. But I love that Robert Altman can bring in an audience to see the new Paul Newman movie and literally give you no Paul Newman. This isn't Paul Newman. This is Buffalo Bill. And this isn't a Western. This is like some weird performance art piece. And he's just fucking with the audience, and I love it. But I know that you have different tastes than I do, so how about you go ahead and tell me what your thoughts were about this Robert Altman experience?
We are going to have some disagreements here, but at the end of the day, this is an Altman fan film. This is the ultimate Altman film, where we've had this discussion before. I'm a fan of not the hand-holding of the characters. I'm a fan of not hand-holding during the story. And this, to me, I'm going to contradict myself quite a bit in this episode, I'm sure. And we get a lot of that. And Altman is notorious for poking fun at history, poking fun utilizing characters to prove a message. But at the end of the day, this one, even given to this exact second, I don't even know how I feel about this movie because I am teetering back and forth. I watched it twice today and I can appreciate it, but at the same time, I keep going back to the negatives of it, of I don't get enough. And that's different than what I felt from a lot of different Altman's films, where we do kind of can read between the lines. But here, it feels like this movie was intended for a different director, where it doesn't go far enough. And I know that's naughty to say about Altman, because that's his intent, is to kind of go in between the lines with his characters to kind of drive that story. But here, it just feels like a lingering question mark of, it needed more. It needed something of a forte to kind of push the messaging. And this is where I'm going to contradict myself again. I, at the same time, loved it about this film that it doesn't. So it's going to be one of those that I'm going to go back and forth on it. But the one thing I will say that I loved about this movie is Paul Lohmann's cinematography. I love the look of it. I love the tone of it. I love the feel of it. But between the characters and Altman's direction, it just didn't connect for me.
And that is a perfectly understandable and acceptable response to a film like this. You know, it's funny, too, when we get to the critics, because first of all, to clarify, they didn't do a full episode on this. This was included in a Best of 76. So this is early in their career, right? And it's really interesting to see like this fresh faced Gene Siskel with his little mustache with a lot more energy than he had later on. Roger Ebert with his big hair, not grayed out yet. Like, it's fun to see them young and excited about movies. And I wish there was more of them talking about this, because a different film critic reviewed it for the Tribune. So, like, it really wasn't even a full review from Roger Ebert at that point. But that's besides the point. I think the thing that I really like to focus on episodes like this and films like this is the fact that a film like this just couldn't be made today. There isn't a director like Robert Altman today. People would turn their nose up at this kind of stuff. Literally the year before this film came out, Altman had one of his biggest successes with Nashville, which is like a 3.5 hour long, almost like a documentary of these fictional country western singers. And it proved how well he worked with a large ensemble cast with very little for them to do. Now, going back to the Alan Rudolph part of this conversation, I had the pleasure of interviewing him during the middle of 2024 about his adaptation of Breakfast of Champions. And that's what got me excited about revisiting this film, is he wrote most of the screenplay for this movie. And the reason why Altman gave it to him is because, you know, he was this young Hollywood writer and he was really good at just writing characters without having to focus on real plot structure. Now, this is based off a stage play that is very structured, very first, second act tale of Buffalo Bill and his show and, you know, his fragile ego and how that crumbles at the end. And Altman wanted him to throw that away and say, I just want to know about the inner workings of this frontier huckster, who was essentially like a snake oil salesman, but with entertainment, telling fictional accounts and hyperbolic accounts of things that happened in Western history, but from the perception of the white man. And then bringing Sitting Bull into this show, because he was, like, you know, out of being a real warrior and having to live his life by white man's ways, and how those two lives would interact and how these two different cultures would interact from the viewpoint of, like, okay, this guy was a legend, but we're literally turning him into like a rodeo clown.
I think when it comes to it, you kind of nailed it, because in no argument is it going to be about the screenplay. Rudolph does a great job. At one point, I even closed my eyes just to listen to the dialogue. The dialogue isn't the problem here. I enjoyed it. I loved where it was going. I loved the interaction between the characters on the spoken word. But I'm going to go back, and I'm probably going to get some backlash on this, is this is where the Altman direction doesn't match the words. Because we can hear some brilliance in conversation. We can see the situational pieces occur between all these characters. We can see, again, the tone and everything working together. But when it comes to Altman's direction on this, I don't think this was the right project for him, because I think there is a lot more in-depth things that happen. There, it could go two different ways in a fork in a road. You can have the dramatic messaging that we can read between the lines, which is brilliant. And then we have the situational piece of the stage play, or the event, if you will, of everything that is the result of the dialogue. So I think when it comes to Altman, I think he nails the situational pieces, but I don't think he really supports the vision of the written word.
I can see how you would think that. And the written word, we have to remember, doesn't mean shit to him. There's a very famous story about when he was directing MASH, and MASH was like his first real big studio project. He had done a few films before it that were, let's say, getting your feet wet in filmmaking. He already had a very vast television career, you know, 30 minutes, or the Colgate Theater that was like 40 minute shows. How can this dude handle a 2 hour thing? So the MASH screenplay was actually very structured, and studio bosses and the screenwriter himself were losing their minds because he was literally telling the actors, don't wait for the next guy to finish his sentence. You guys can talk all over each other. That's how life is. There are people, especially in hierarchies, if there is a commander or an officer, who is just going to start talking over the people below him. And so MASH feels like controlled chaos because the screenplay doesn't even matter anymore. If you run out of words, just say more words. And I feel like this is the same formula he used for MASH, especially when we're getting introduced to all the characters like in the first 20 minutes. We've got Joel Grey, we've got Harvey Keitel, we've got Kevin McCarthy and Burt Lancaster and Geraldine Chaplin, like this amazing cast. As we are being introduced to them, you better be paying attention, because they're literally saying people's names and brief histories while they're speaking over each other. I think that is such an Altman idiosyncrasy that if you don't know it and if you don't expect it, you will feel like, okay, he's kind of dropping the ball in letting us know what these people are all about, and I'm kind of here for it. It's like seeing a free-form jazz band or a punk band that just goes up there and jams, or like seeing Fish or Grateful Dead with 10-minute guitar solos. That's what this feels like, but as a film. So while I agree with you 100% that there is a lot to be desired in the terms of dialogue matching the scene, I'm also in there ready to say, okay, I'm going to have my left ear listening to Paul Newman and my right ear listening to Joel Grey, because I know that if I focus on one person, I am not going to get all of the subtext.
It really is, and I'm not going to disagree with anything you just said, but where I will just zero in is, again, the question mark of something missing. And when we zero in and kind of spiderweb his direction, and we go into the appreciation. I know what Altman's trying to do, but we just feel like we should have something more given the story. And even if we take our Paul Newman character, our Buffalo Bill, it feels like he wants this character. If we're looking at Altman to poke fun at the historics of this character, to go further, to be more egotistical than what we see him deliver, this is a character direction that I think is one of his more faulted movies, where we don't get enough from the actual characters. I mean, the most intriguing character to me is our Sitting Bull character, and he has no spoken words. It's the presence of it. It's the way Altman directs it. He focuses on this character that makes it intriguing. And again, we miss that topic of why this character is intriguing. It's because Altman is making him intriguing based on his direction, but we don't get any other emotion out of the character direction from Altman with any of the other supporting cast. So I think that is just a fault in the storytelling of it. But again, I will contradict myself. I can appreciate and I can analyze this movie, and I will probably analyze this movie for the next 2 weeks, trying to figure out what the intent is. And I think it's not about messaging here, because we kind of get the in-your-face climax of messaging in a way that Altman can only do, but there's no build to it. So I think the intent is the big question mark that I have a problem with this film, especially when it zeroes in on the character direction to prove Altman's point.
I think there's something really fascinating about how the Native Americans are represented as almost they have like a hive mind. So Will Sampson plays Halsey, who is the translator for Sitting Bull. But is he really the translator, or is he really like the brains behind the operation? Because like you said, we never hear Sitting Bull speak, except for like when he is saying things in his native language during one of the performances, which is, you know, lost on the audience. And that's intentional. All of the philosophical and Native American, let's say, isms that are shown and spoken all come from Will Sampson. I think it's a very brilliant thing to do. I'm not sure if that's how the stage play works, but Will Sampson, fresh off of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, so he's definitely recognizable, gives an amazing performance as essentially the mouth of Sauron, right? He is the one that is doing all the communication between Sitting Bull and the handlers of the Buffalo Bill show. But what I like about it is that there's a very central, streamlined wave of thought coming from Halsey and Sitting Bull's, you know, spoken mind, essentially, compared to the utter chaos and buffoonery of the white man in Buffalo Bill's show. You know, you got Joel Grey as the producer, you got Harvey Keitel as the nephew, Buffalo Bill himself, of course, Kevin McCarthy is like one of the main kind of entertainers of this whole show, and none of them have a coherent thought between them. It's all jumbled, it's all mixed up, and they're trying to put the show together, and the natives are so organized and focused on everything, they seem like completely outlandish and ridiculous to these chaotic white guys. Now, obviously, that's an intentional move by the director and the screenwriter. And how it comes off on screen, I think, is fascinating because it makes the mysticism of the Native Americans, which are already very mystical, in my opinion, even more so, because it's just leaving these white guys dumbfounded. And the quirky characters that Rudolph, in his writing, and Altman in his direction, for example, Paul Newman, you can tell that he loves this performance, because how many movies have we seen Paul Newman just be Paul Newman? It's like Brad Pitt or Robert Redford, right? You're the pretty guy and people love the charm you bring to the screen, so just do that. But here he gets to play a character. He gets to live in someone else's body and mind, and you know, that fragile ego and the weird things he's got going on, and that great final monologue at the end, which I'll get to more in a little bit. But you can see Paul Newman just eating up this role, because you can tell it's something he doesn't get to do very often. And I love seeing him have fun with this role. And in that fun comes all these weird characters. Of course, they're all the white people. The fact that he is almost required to have a white operatic singer in his tent just sing nonsense throughout the entire movie. I mean, either that was the marijuana on set doing the talking, or that was just a real amazing director and character choice of saying, you know what? I want Buffalo Bill to have a portly white woman sing everything operatically, not speak to him, but sing in a high-pitched vibrato for no reason whatsoever other than because it's interesting. And we have seen other filmmakers emulate that since then. I would say Robert Downey Sr. in Putney Swope with the Japanese characters that light firecrackers, which Paul Thomas Anderson emulated in Boogie Nights during the scene with Alfred Molina, where you got a guy just throwing firecrackers in the background for no reason. It's a distraction that leaves you so puzzled as to what you are watching, you can't help but be intrigued. And this movie is full of those. I just think that there is so much more to this as a movie that can just be looked at as like some weird sideshow folly piece. Like, what the hell was Altman thinking? But like, I'm on the ride for that. So yeah, I agree with you that this is a hard watch for some people, but like I've said in many other episodes, this just tickles that right bone for me, where I am so fascinated of the why, and it's the why that draws me in, and it's the why that makes me want to watch it again. I should have watched it a second time like you did. I need to watch it more. I haven't gotten all of the messaging that Altman's put out to me yet, and I can't wait to revisit it.
Well, I will 100% agree with you, because this movie isn't going to be one that is one, two, and done. This is one that has enough nuggets in it that I am going to continue to watch it, because there is so much hanging fruit here that I don't think I will do this movie justice without seeing it a couple more times. Because this one, you can't just watch once and call it a fair assessment. But I will say this, that on the top of my notes watching this, the opera singer drove the fuck out of me. I was going nuts. I hated the opera singer. But after I watched it the second time, this is where I zeroed in and took a little bit away from, because this is a movie not about characters, but about communication through history, where we get a lot of the singing from the opera that's kind of setting the scene for Bill. Then we have the interpreter, like you spoke to, but there was a scene that it really did connect the dots with me towards the climax, where we get the president and we get Sitting Bull talking in his native tongue, and the president says, I didn't understand a word he said. And there's significance to that, because if we look at communication today, there's so many various vast pieces of communication. But when we look at the timestamp here, this is where we can actually overthink it a little bit to say, how was communication like this here? And this is where we have the Buffalo Bill character really take ego over communication, is that his communication is better. The white man's communication is better. And we don't really listen to what the interpreter is saying. And you're right. It could be what he's saying, or he could be playing chess. We don't know. But it's the emotion put into the dialogue of how we translate those words of significance. So is the spoken word to our main characters important? And are we speaking with passion? So I think there is a bigger aspect here of how we communicate during this time and through time. So watching this movie today, I think there is a big significance of looking at the communication piece of it, taking it away. So, I mean, and again, that's just a little nugget that we can take away, and there's going to be a lot more that's going to tie the dots the more I watch this movie. So it would be unfair to me to say this is a bad movie. It's not. It's not a bad movie. It is a deep movie if you are, like you said, you're patient and you pay attention to what's happening on screen.
I love the idea that both Rudolph and Altman are using, let's say, Buffalo Bill as an analogy or a metaphor of like the modern day, or at least modern day of this time, 1976, rock star lifestyle, right? Where everyone is just very eccentric and self-destructive. You could say that Buffalo Bill is the equivalent of a Jimi Hendrix or a Mick Jagger trashing hotel rooms, or having, like, you would picture Mick Jagger having an opera singer hanging out in his hotel room and singing nonsense while they're all drinking their asses off, right? Like, I feel there's a definite connection of them saying this is the rock star lifestyle of this particular era, where frontiersmen don't really exist anymore, so they're sideshow follies. This is the new rock star of that time, right? That I love that analogy, and that's where the fragile ego comes from. And that brilliant final 10 minutes of the movie, where we find out that Sitting Bull has been killed in an escape from like a prison situation, and Paul Newman, in a very theatrical setting, like it almost looks like it could be a stage play. It is based off a stage play. This big, wide shot of this, you know, frontier cabin set of Newman wandering back and forth across this living room and bedroom area. And everywhere he turns as he's soliloquying, he sees the ghost of Sitting Bull in every frame. You know, he turns the stairs and he's on the stairs. He turns to the kitchen, he's sitting at the table. He turns to the bedroom, he's standing by the door. That moment is so different than the energy of the rest of the movie. And I love that's the way that they chose to end the film, because it does show the fragility of this boisterous character. And that even though throughout the movie, we see him show nothing but disrespect to Sitting Bull, Halsey, and the rest of the natives, that now in this moment, like, is closing off the movie, and he knows that this legend is no longer with us, that he's finally paying his respects to him, not just as an entertainer, but as a warrior and as someone to look up to. I mean, that got me. Like, I'm not going to say I teared up, but when the hair on your arms and the back of your neck raise from the emotional intensity of that scene, like I said, this isn't Newman playing cool guy Newman. This is him playing a character, and it just showed how good the guy really was at his craft and not just being the sexy movie star. Great scene, great ending for a film.
And I think the biggest part of the arc of the Newman character is when we actually get that photography scene where everybody's grouped together and you're kind of going back and forth with where Sitting Bull's going to sit because he can't stand next to Annie Oakley and all this. So I think that is a moment that was the pivotal moment of what's going to lead to that emotional element towards the end. My problem with it is it wasn't until that moment that I connected with the climax. So we can take that stardom, if you will, of this figure, but that is the issue with it, is I don't think we get enough of that. We wait for that singular moment to say, this guy's a dick. And
right,
that's where we really connect with who we want to root for, if you will. And it's not going to be the Buffalo Bill character, because right when you kind of take your stardom, and we can relate that to today, where you use your power to kind of place the chess pieces to move people around, integrate people outside of the white man, this is where it really does have a relatability factor of, I hate this character. I hate the way he's treating these people. And that's where it really does have a connection with the viewer. So, but it takes, for me at least, that moment to really hit home for it, where you're actually controlling where somebody is sitting, where somebody is standing. And that's where I think this movie could have used more of that to really prove this point. But again, with an Altman picture, you're not going to get that throughout. So that's my contradiction in this statement.
And before we move on to the critics' review for the show, I got to say that I loved the score. And the score was done by a guy named Richard Baskin, who did not really have a lot of things under his belt other than a few other Altman films and a film called Euphoria, which is super rare, which I love. But he was the musical director and soundtrack producer for Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. So there is a connection there. But once again, like, that whimsical freeform music to go with a whimsical freeform film, you wouldn't think would work on any other type of project other than an Altman project, because, like I said, the controlled chaos of that guy is what made him so unique and memorable. And this is a film that was lost for years, man. Like, it's known as the lost Altman film. It had a $7 million budget, and it made $7.2 million back, mostly from VHS rentals. So that just goes to show that if there was ever an Altman cult film, this might be it. Because it was people that really had to seek this thing out to view it and appreciate it. And looking at the Rotten Tomatoes scores and Letterboxd scores, it's a split. It's either 1.5, 2 stars or 4 and 5 stars. And to me, that just speaks Altman's legend right there. You either love it or you fucking hate it.
Well, this is one of those movies that I would put on my shelf of just ones I want to revisit to just figure out. It's like the puzzle you put in your closet that you just revisit every year just to reconstruct it. This is one that I can't say I'm not going to watch 2, 3, 4 more times. Is it because I enjoy it? No. It's because I enjoy the chase of the messaging. I enjoy the chase of the vision of what Altman's trying to do. So this is one of those movies that you have to have full attention on, and don't expect to get it on the first take, because this one, I know I will enjoy the third or fourth time, but I didn't enjoy it the first two times, but I know I will down the road.
Well, and that's what I'm going to say about this movie, is that you may feel like you're finished with this film, but this film is not finished with you. It hasn't given you all it has to give yet. And like I said, I definitely need to see it again, because as much as I loved it this time, I don't even remember all my feelings the first time I watched it all those years ago, but like, I am just anticipating the next visit. So like I said, this wasn't a full episode review from Siskel and Ebert. This is 1976, very early on in their day. I loved actually this entire episode of their Best of 76 because they don't have like a really good cohesive plan on how to introduce the films and talk about them yet. It seems very raw and kind of impromptu, and I like that. But they do have some pretty good discourse on it. So this was number 8 on Gene's top 10 of 1976.
My number 8 choice, Robert Altman's Buffalo Bill and the Indians, bored a lot of people, but not me. This was a bittersweet comedy that tried to expose Buffalo Bill as America's first superstar and also as a bigoted show business phony who thought the only good Indians were either dead Indians or one working as secondary acts in his show. Paul Newman played Bill just fine. He played him as a vain jerk.
So, number 8 on his list. Doesn't spend a whole lot of time complimenting Newman, but what he said is enough. He does a good job. He doesn't feel like Paul Newman. He is playing this guy as a braggart, you know? So we hear about Buffalo Bill being legendary and brave and you know, bringing the tales of the Old West to these, you know, small communities that have only ever read books about these things, and now we're showing them Native American fights and frontier wars and things like that. And this kind of shows that it was really just kind of sideshow stuff, right? It was a circus without a circus. And the fact that people did find it boring, but he didn't, it makes so much sense to me that this would be a film that he likes, because we've heard Roger tear films like this apart, but we've heard Gene defend them from time to time because, like I always said, Gene is always more fascinated by the characters and by what like the director is doing less often than Roger is. Roger likes the good old-fashioned, give me a movie. If it's a comedy, make me laugh. If it's a horror film, make me scared, where he isn't as appreciative of free-form experimental filmmaking as Gene is. So I think this is an earlier version of Gene. He's not so jaded. I don't think he's built this facade of pretentiousness that he would show us later. I'm seeing a real cinema fan in this review.
Yeah, I mean, Gene nails it. But here's the danger, especially with me, is a first-time watch where this is where kind of the age gap and the experience and growth happens, is when we take a topic, this is where we have to put aside our experiences and our psyche and just watch the movie for what it is. Because when we look at this, we almost, at least me, want Paul Newman's character to be a bigger jerk. We want him to be have this persona of being more of an asshole and not treated in a glorified way in some aspects because of the hatred. So to me, it's almost a danger. And Gene saw this movie at the perfect time, along with Roger, where we don't have the topics at the forefront that we have today. We don't have the teachings that we have today that they, we don't have the teaching. They didn't have the teachings back then as we have today. So to me, it's a selfish critique, but it's something where it's hard to ignore when I'm watching a movie from the 70s to now, when the topic of Native Americans, racism, and this character that's just glorified that doesn't go far enough to show the fall of stardom.
And you know, like, how hard would it be to Dino De Laurentiis definitely said it was hard. How hard would it be to market a movie like this? You can't make a good trailer for this film because this film doesn't really have any trailer worthy moments, and any kind of marketing or trailer you're going to put out into the public is going to be deceptive. Because no one wants to see a movie about shitty Buffalo Bill being shitty to Indians or being shitty to the people that work for him. So I'm sure that in the trailer, which I watched, it does not feel like the film that you actually get. So there is a deception in the way this film was marketed, because it's like, how do you really market a movie like this? The same can be said about so many Altman movies. Shortcuts especially. It's 3.5 hours of just people talking in Los Angeles and doing stupid Los Angeles shit. How do you make an effective trailer for a movie like that? You already have to have an audience built in. So I can tell that this was really built for the MASH and Nashville audience. And I think because MASH and Nashville were so popular amongst critics and amongst the trade papers, even though they're not for everyone, the star power of those movies and the cultural impact of those movies made audiences think that, oh, a Robert Altman film can't lose.
7% solution, witty, sophisticated, The Man Who Would Be King, a lot of fun, but I cannot agree with you on Robert Altman's Buffalo Bill and the Indians.
What didn't you like about it?
Well, because it was a disappointment stylistically from Altman, who I think is really one of the most exciting American directors, and I thought Nashville was the best picture of last year, but I didn't know what he was trying to tell us this time, and I'm not sure he did either.
Oh, I think it's pretty clear he wanted to show us that this guy was a buffoon and that he was exploitive and that the whole business of entertainment started back even a century ago.
But he buried the buffoonery and the character and the business of entertainment in such a complex stylistic muddle that it was very hard at times to figure out what you were supposed to be looking at or what you were supposed to be responding to.
Somehow I knew.
Somehow he knew. I'm going to go out and say right now that I don't think Roger has enough experience in the industry under his belt at this point in his career to really make those kind of judgments, because obviously I already made the Rockstar comparison, but the way this production is handled and the energy and chaos of all the people putting it together, this movie is a metaphor for the movie industry. It's a metaphor for Hollywood, new Hollywood of the 70s, where it's alcohol and drug infused. There's a chase for the meaning of things through mysticism, e.g. the Native American mysticism, and the fact that the most interesting characters are the characters who speak their truth, which is Halsey and Sitting Bull. But the characters that get the most attention from the dumb audiences that pay their money to see them are the buffoons of the industry. It's a metaphor. And I don't think Roger has been indoctrinated into the industry at 1976 by this point to really understand that metaphor. Make this movie 10 years later, he'd probably be the one preaching about the metaphor and the idiosyncrasies that are pretty much identical to the film industry. I mean, he was writing books about it by the mid-80s, about the movie industry and how hard it is to be a critic and watching all this bullshit. This movie is really about that. I just don't think he's there yet.
So I guess it's time to be honest here. I didn't listen to Roger's review. I didn't do my homework. I apologize, because I wanted a fresh piece of Roger here. And that, and it was, his reviews are buried, even his written review for this film. But I can't disagree with him, honestly, because here is, I think you touched on a lot of great points, but here is where he really related to me on his review, is he felt the same way I did when it comes to the characters, is it's hard to tell what he's trying to prove because the characters don't go far enough. We almost need to go and be, you don't want to go outlandish and sideshow-ish. You don't want to go too far, but you don't want to go underwhelming. You have to find that sweet spot. And I think that's really what's missing here that I spoke to earlier, is I wanted more from our Buffalo Bill character. I didn't want this kind of linear character that says offensive things. I wanted him portrayed in a way that I can relate to disliking this guy. I wanted a way to dislike his actions and our past. And Roger, a huge advocate as he goes on in years for civil rights, that is where Roger is really telling his origin story here of, he needed more of this topic, and this is one of those that, as I skipped over his review, but he didn't really review this movie in his written review, and he is an Altman fan. Most of his movies are between 3.5 and 4 stars, but I do agree with him, is the characters just don't go far enough, so it's hard to disagree, but at the same time, you're right. This is kind of where he is just getting his feet wet in how to view a movie. And even I am admitting right now that this is one that if I were to write a review today, I would have to see this 3 or 4 times just to do it justice.
No, that's a very, very valid point. I think that at the end of the day, the things that I think modern day audiences watching this movie, if they have the patience for it, because this is not a movie for people who are holding their phones the entire time, right? This is a put your phone away, listen to the dialogue, observe the characters, observe the metaphors they're making. Like the fact that even the president of the United States in this movie is enjoying a show that is literally revisionist history. Like, he is watching a show where Custer is the winner. And we all know that that wasn't the case. We're going through that shit in modern times where revisionist history takes over fact. And I think that is one of the points that this thing was trying to make, was it doesn't matter what really happened. In order to entertain the dumb masses, which is the reason why we have movies that you're giving 1.5, 2 stars to over the last decade, is that they're not making movies for quality anymore. They're literally making movies just to get people into a theater so they can get the popcorn money. And the reviews that you and I have put out show it. This is that. This is a metaphor about that, is people don't want truth. People want entertainment. And they would, especially at this time, before, you know, we have, you know, civil rights and modern day movements, the people were so just blindsided by their own personal opinions and lifestyles that to them, revisionist history is more entertaining and illuminating than watching something that portrays the real history. And again, I think Altman, who was a civil rights activist as well, was making a point with that. So there are so many deeper levels to this movie that you're not going to get in the first time. And I'll go back to my main point. You have to want what this movie is giving to you. You can't just sit there and accept that. You have to want to accept it. And that's a big ask for an audience. So I get from like people in your perspective or Rogers, if you're trying to tell people to go spend their money on this movie in the theater without giving them some forewarning of, hey, you have to be ready to accept what this movie is. You can't just go in there blind. I agree with you.
This makes sense that this was a bigger release on VHS because you can hit rewind and watch it. So this is one of those, if it were to come out today, this is where I would encourage streaming almost, because this one you can take your time with and digest it, because there is, like you said brilliantly, a lot of layers to it, and you're going to take something away from it every single viewing, and it is a challenge. And the one thing I will say when it comes to the release, especially with Roger, is the benefit to back then is that they didn't have phones. So there are no distractions. You can put full attention on the screen. So the intelligence levels back then and how you digest entertainment versus metaphors or symbolic or themes is a lot simpler than it is today. So I know with me, I had to put down my phone for 5 minutes, rewind it, and go back to it. So that is the danger in this generation to watch this movie. So like you said, you're going to watch this movie, you literally need to lock your phone away, put eyes onto the screen, and appreciate the intent of what's happening, and take moments to appreciate and digest what's being told on screen.
I mean, I'm sure you'll agree with me that they don't and probably can't make movies like this anymore, because that audience is gone. Like, the only audience for this movie are people like us who I think are just cinema appreciators and have done enough homework to understand what a movie like this is actually going to do to you as an audience member, not just a casual film watcher for the sake of, oh, I'm going to watch a movie. It's not what it is. I don't think we should score our critics this week, because this wasn't really a full review from either. But I will just have to say that I am so impressed by Gene that this made his top 10 of 1976. All the movies that were in 1976 and on their lists are classics. You had Network. You had Rocky on there. To have Buffalo Bill and the Indians on your top 10 for 1976, I thought was really impressive. It also makes sense that Roger didn't have it on his.
What's really impressive is Gene's mustache. That thing is beautiful.
I know. Why did he shave it, man?
Absolutely. But I think this is one of Gene's better reviews. I really wish this would have been a back and forth conversation during an actual show, because I would have loved to get more snippets, especially from Roger, since we don't really get anything from him on the back end of it. So I think this would have been one of those movies that would have been a very intriguing discussion between both of them. When you go full Gene Siskel, 4 stars, and who knows what Roger rated it, probably, if he's not giving it a thumbs down, 2, 2.5. So that would have been a great contradicting conversation that I would have loved to view.
I mean, it blew my mind. I went to Roger's website, and there is a section of all of the Altman films that he reviewed. There's like only 3 missing, and this was one of them. So that's pretty crazy, because he was such an Altman fan, and he did so much lip service for the guy, and this one's not even in there because he never reviewed it for the paper. It's fascinating. Oh, well, good conversation. And this one, I'm glad that we did an episode on, because I don't think I would have revisited it on my own unless we had this conversation. And like I said, it was all sparked from that talk with Alan Rudolph, where he said he got the job writing for Altman based off of writing an adaptation of this play. And from the way it sounds like, it's like the movie adaptation. He was given a project and was like, I can't adapt this the way you want me to, so I'm just going to adapt it the way my mind works. And thank you for it, because it's such a different type of movie. All right, well, we're going way off kilter for next week. So next week, going back into our groove of, let's say, comfort movies for us, movies that we like, movies that we know we're going to enjoy, and then we can be a little bit more critical about our reviewers. We've got 1997's Event Horizon, directed by Paul W.S. Anderson, starring Sam Neill and Lawrence Fishburne. Some call it one of the best sci-fi horror movies ever made. Some call it garbage. We'll see what Justin and I have to say about it, and we'll see what Roger and Gene have to say about it.
I love how we go from a thought-provoking Altman film to just a bloody horror movie from the 90s, so I love it.
A Paul W.S. Anderson movie. Arguably his best, but still a Paul W.S. Anderson movie nonetheless. All right, so everyone, thank you for watching, listening. Please go rate, review, subscribe, give us 5 stars to Back to the Balcony on Apple or Spotify. Please subscribe and review our YouTube channel. And you can find me, Antonio, the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast, over at thecultworthy.com. And you can find my co-host, Justin, over at
themoviewire.com.
And we will see you next week.
See you next week.